You can get 3 months of The Spectator if you subscribe before the election for just £3, plus a free election mug. Just go to spectator.co.uk/mug.
Hello and welcome to the Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and this week I'm joined by Åsne Seierstad, author of the best-selling The Bookseller of Kabul, whose new book is The Afghans, Three Lives Through War, Love and Revolt. Åsne, welcome. Can you tell me, first of all, what you were sort of trying to do with this book? I mean, a huge amount's been written, some of a great deal by you, about Afghanistan over the last 40, 50, 60 years. What did you think this approach to it would achieve?
Well, the reason I went back after 20 years of absence after I wrote The Bookseller was that everything that was hoped when I wrote that book about, you know, liberalization, democratization, freedom for women and so on, and prosperity for everyone, that failed dramatically, in the sense that the worst enemy of us all in the war on terror, the Taliban, took 100% power, took all the power in the country. And I decided to go back to find out how is it to live under the new Taliban, what had happened on the way, what had made them so powerful. And for that, I needed to just go back and see for myself and report on the first year of Taliban rule.
But you're, I mean, it's a book that does an awful lot more than report on the first year of Taliban war. It goes right back. I mean, were you trying to get a sense, and maybe you can tell us what sort of sense you got of the way in which what you call the new Taliban differed from version one, and kind of how they got there?
Yes, in order to understand the Taliban today, I had to go back, and I had to go back to the, well, I start in the 70s. A lot started with the Soviet invasion. So I follow three people, those who are born in the 70s, I start in the 70s, those who are born in the 80s, I start in the 80s, and those who are born after 9/11, I start later. But in order to understand the movement, of course, those last 20 years are crucial. What I found as a difference is, of course, it's the same movement, and they themselves insist that it's the same movement. Mm-hmm. And when I ask them, what do you want to achieve? It's to go back to how it was in the 90s, even though for them that is moving forward. The difference is partly that the world has moved on technologically. Like the Taliban won, they were against all technology, and in the country there were hardly any phones anyway, but now they are on their iPhones, they're on their MacBooks and so on. The other thing is that they want more to cooperate with the world. So at least part of the movement wants to be part of the world. So in that sense, they are more slick or try to be more diplomatic. But in the end, it's the same movement. Another slight difference when it comes to women is that girls are allowed to go to school until the age of 12, whereas before it was no education at all for girls. But it's a same patriarchic movement, but this time there are also splits within the movement where some are more, I wouldn't call them progressive, but they're more moderate. But the ruler on top, the emir, Haibatullah Akhundzada, is totally as the most conservative Taliban that ever existed. Like he rules with the council of elders and religious scholars. And in his world, women do not exist on the streets. Girls do not need any education apart from, you know, what they can learn at home. And as long as he's alive, there will be no change in Afghanistan.
The approach to the book, my understanding is your background, you're a war reporter, you do news. And this, it's something much more like a novel, as I guess The Bookseller was as well. What's the value of that to you, and how did you find yourself switching gears? When did you start thinking there's a different way of telling these stories?
Well, for me, the value is for the reader to enter the perspective of the one I'm telling about. So, of course, that involves a lot of work for me because I need to know as much as possible about that person, how he or she thinks, how he acts, what is, you know, motives and aspirations and thoughts. So it's a lot of, very often I end up, you know, people tell their stories about, let's say, Bashir, who's the Taliban in the book, who's a, you know, started off as a young boy where Osama bin Laden was his hero. He entered the Quran schools and the training camps of the very brutal Haqqani networks, and he grew in the ranks as, you know, his superiors died. So he became in the end a very, he's typical in the sense that he's coming from the countryside and inherited the war from his father, who was killed during the Soviet war. And this was, you know, he was, as he sees it, he's securing his way of life. So he tells his story, and very often I will ask him, but what did you think then? What were your feelings? Like, he's in the battle, but he doesn't just tell how he's fighting the Americans, but what he feels that every, you know, so it's so that kind of interviewing that you need to be in his perspective. So that I've had readers, a lot of them actually, who tell me when, like, there is this battle, his first battle with Americans, and he misses the first bullet, he misses the second bullet, and he knows, if I miss the third bullet now, because he's only got 5 bullets. They had such a big lack of bullets and ammunition at the time. This is the beginning of the war.
Were these not sort of rockets?
Yeah, rockets.
No, rockets, sorry, rather than rockets, actual bullets.
Yes, he's got 5, yes, of course, sorry, translation. So he knows that, you know, he thinks that, oh, if I miss now, they will use me as a suicide bomber, and he wants to survive the war. And then I've had readers who tell me, like, oh, I hope he doesn't miss. Like, he needs to shut this now. He needs to reach the target. He needs to reach the tanks. And then they're like, wow, did I just? Yes, the reader enters his perspective.
A bit too much identification.
That's maybe too much of an identification. But it's like, if we don't know and understand our enemy, how are we going to beat it? And I think that is one of the major mistakes, now that I'm jumping back and forth there on thematically, but that's one of the major mistakes we did, that we didn't never really understood the Taliban.
I mean, the sort of depth of research in this, I'm a little fascinated by what you allow yourself, because I come across paragraphs that say things like, he took out a packet of dental floss from his pocket. One of the men rubbed at his glass eye. Another let out a cough. Outside, the afternoon was growing dark. And I think, how could you know that?
I was there.
How could you know that? But you were there at that one.
Yes.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes. Yes, of course. Yes. Because that's part of the book, is the first year of the Taliban. So there I'm sitting with them. And I always had my iPhone in the middle of the room, you know, so that this is an interview session. And it was interesting with Bashir, Commander Bashir, that he's also, he understood the media, or actually, how to say, he gave me a lot of, you know, freedom of, you know, being able to record everything. And he told people around him, you know, whatever you tell me today, like him, you tell her too. Like, if you want to hide anything, don't tell it now, because she's recording everything. And I got all those tapes. Well, I had a translator when I was there, but that's not always accurate, because everything goes quickly. And then when I went home, I got everything transcribed from Pashto, so that then I got also, you know, the small talk and word by word. And that's why it's quite accurate and quite colorful in their talking. But
there's such thickness of detail. Yeah. It's extraordinary. Now, Bashir is, obviously, in some ways, he's the most kind of jaw-dropping figure, because his worldview is so alien to the liberal West. And what do you think, I mean, first, how did you find him and persuade him to cooperate? And second, you know, what do you think was in it for him as he saw it, to be describing what he'd done? You know, a lot of these things, you know, he was very badly tortured, we should say, by the Western powers, or at least by the then Afghan government. You know, he presumably would like some plausible deniability. What was in it for him?
Status, the fact that he suddenly had a biographer following him. And the Taliban personalities are not very well documented. When I got there, I went to the, you know, as all journalists have to do, you go to the foreign ministry and you get your accreditation, and they ask you, what are you going to do? What are you going to write about? And I said, you know, I want to write a book about the Taliban as individuals, because we know the Taliban as a movement, but not so much as individuals. And I wanted a high level person. And then I was meeting the vice minister of foreign affairs. So I asked him, you know, I had to be quick. So I was like, maybe you want to be part of the book, I said. And he was like, no way. And you you're not going to succeed in this because we don't talk. The Taliban don't talk. And there are no books on the individuals. And I mentioned one book, which is by an ex-Taliban, My Life with the Taliban. And he said, yes, I know that book, but that is the only one. And that person is no longer in the Taliban movement. He was like, good luck. You get your, you know, accreditation. You can travel freely around. So, and then I went from, you know, government structures to military structures because it's after all a military movement. So I went around to police stations and military camps. And after a week or so interviewing different people, I had a meeting with Commander Bashir. And I understood with him that they were like, he was a level up intellectually and, you know, the presence, like as a journalist, we at least, I think I do have some kind of an instinct of what kind of people will work. And there's several things that, of course, they need to be good storytellers and they need to have a story to tell. But they also have to be something that you feel there's a consistency with them. Is this a person who will, you know, hold for a year or will he withdraw? And the interesting thing was like he had lots of questions to me, which is very seldom, like people were, you know, they filled with their own stories. And he was like, okay, why did you come? Why are you interested in the Taliban? And I tried to tell him about, you know, all the wars I'd covered to, you know, to make, you know, I'm someone. I did Syria, I did Libya, I did Afghanistan before, I did Chechnya. And he was like, so how come you only cover wars in Muslim countries? Do you have anything against the Islam? And I was like, no. And, you know, I was trying to, yeah, I felt I just blew it. But then he said, okay. And then early on, I said, well, ask if I need to know you as an individual. I know, you know, the clan, the family is important in Afghanistan. I need to know your family. I need to know your wives, because he was then getting his third wife and your mother. And he's like, okay, I'm going to ask them. Then one by one, I also met his wives who lived together, but first one wanted to see me and then the next. So he was very open, and I did the status that I was now quick to answer the reason why. It's like, I wondered too, why? And then I spoke to a scholar called Abdul Said. He's at the Carnegie Institute, and he listened through all the tapes with Bashir afterwards, he knew about him and just for me to get a sense of who he is. And he is also the one who said, you know, obviously status, that to have, you know, someone who trails his past and goes around. And when he, you know, took me along to visit the martyrs, the family of the martyrs of his, because he's still nurturing his soldiers, because who knows what's going to happen.
Well, he's very keen to go and invade Pakistan, isn't he, in the later part of the book?
Absolutely. And he has war in himself. And I remember early on, like during the first year of the Taliban rule, and he's like, you know, just a few months after the victory, he wants to go and conquer Pakistan you know, from the infidels, as he sees the Pakistani government to be. And I said, look, you know, you got the power now, you got your, you know, great house, you got everything, but look at the roads, look at the buildings, look at the countryside, look at the agriculture. Don't you want to now rebuild your country instead of spending so much resources on a new war? And then he was like, you mean like what? And it's like, rebuilding. And he was like, yeah, but how? And I was like, well, okay. So I realized he hadn't even thought of it, that that's part of his role. And I was like, okay, to rebuild the country, don't you need, people need work. So what about, you have no production here. Yeah, you don't even produce your own shoes, your own clothes. Like, everything is imported from Pakistan. So I kind of had to explain to him, like, how to rebuild a country. So who knows if it changes. But that's also a tragic truth about, it's a generation of young men. He's now, he was 35 then, so he's now 37. Like, a young man, still young. Who have done nothing but fight, whose major moments in life are moments of defeat or victory and death and loss. So I think it needs a total mental makeover for the Taliban movement to also change from this military way of life to a more constructive and way of life, way of thought.
What did you make of him personally? Can I say, because you spent a lot of time in his company. Did you like him?
Yes, I did. And I think I came across very well-functioning Taliban family. And whereas when I did the bookseller's family, that was kind of dysfunctional family. And so it's like, that doesn't go with, you know, that you can have the best ideological views and you have dysfunctional families and vice versa. So what I realized that, you know, these three wives, they really loved him. And so again, the perspective, and that is something that I really tried to find out among those wives who had been part of the war, who had made the road bombs, because that's, you know, like a recipe you just make and put together with gasoline and sugar and some other ingredients, and they sewed, you know, suicide vests, and they've really been part of it. And they also miss the war now because they felt life was boring. But yeah, it's like nothing happens. And it's also like we don't get any rewards now because, you know, rewards to get the best place in paradise afterwards.
But there is an extraordinary and kind of telling moment, which seemed to me the most alien to me of the whole book. You could sort of understand why, you know, he fetched out the Mujahideen, why he didn't like the Americans. But this moment when he loses one of his children and he's sort of shouting with joy because he says, you know, God is going to reward me or reward the child in paradise. And that seems
going to reward them all for that loss of a child, because the child is the chosen one. God chose that child. So two of the wives spent the war with him. The third one, who's 16-year-old, he married within that first year. So the two wives, they just realized, you know, when they met that, you know, we're into this together. After some time, they just, you know, but they tried to like each other and they managed to like each other and they managed to cooperate. One lost every second child. So, you know, half of the children would die during the war. The other one had more surviving children. But the first two children, he lost his two first children, right, from the first wife. You're not supposed to cry. You're not supposed to grieve. And what they said, if the mother cries or if anyone cries, every teardrop becomes a river that the child has to cross on their way to paradise, and it might even drown in it. But if it goes across, you know, without drowning, that child is going to, you know, when you die as a mother, the child will kind of drag you over as well. So it was all these stories that they're like, it's as if they tell a story about a holiday trip they've heard of, like, you know, you cross that river and then you come to the bank and the child would, because what happens is like a cord will grow between the two and you're dragged over. These things, they just know for certain. Everything is, you know, paradise is a real place you can travel to. And for my translator at the time, I had a female translator translate for the women. She had never heard of this. So it's like, this is not an Afghan thing. This is a Taliban thing. This is constructed in order to, you know, you lose so many. And it's the same with, the, you know, the suicide bombers. Like, you know, they need to know what happens after to, you know, to survive or to, you know, mentally survive. So it's like, this is not, it's many things in the Taliban movement that are purely Taliban. And it's not really all of it based in the Quran, or it's more obscure. So a regular Afghan have a total different way of looking at this.
So did you have a sense while you talked to Bashir? We'll move on to Jamila in a second. But did you have a sense when you talked to Bashir of things that he wasn't prepared to talk about or wasn't, or was spinning or was, I mean, it sounds like he's been very open. But is, I mean, did he care what you thought? Did he care what the outside world thought? Was he kind of trimming accordingly?
Yeah, I think that he doesn't really care so much what the outside world thinks, but he cares what the Taliban thinks. And he expects this book to be translated to Pashto, which is, it hasn't yet. And he wasn't even interested in, you know, because I let everyone in the book, if they wanted to read it through before publication, he said, oh, you know, I don't care, but when you have a Pashto translation, I want to read it. And, you know, see if I need to make any adjustments. But for the English version, I don't care. I think he was very guarded too. And he was he knew what he wanted to talk about, what he did not want to talk about. For instance, he's sentenced to death. He has a death sentence towards the end of the book. And he's then saved by Trump and the Trump agreement, when the Taliban asks for, we need the release of 5,000 Taliban prisoners in order to sign here. And the Trump team just says, okay, which was, of course, a terrible mistake to release them all, among them Bashir, who was on death row. So in his sentence, there are several, and I got the full sentence, and it's attacks against police stations. You know, he is head of suicide squads, so it's like attacks of hospitals, attacks of schools. He is accused of kidnapping two American and Australian professors and several other businessmen. He was a moneymaker too, and the main money came from kidnapping. And they didn't behead them like in ISIS. They got money for them, and most of them were in Waziristan in Pakistan. So there were several crimes that he was accused of. When I asked him, okay, so tell me about those crimes one by one, and he said, some of them I committed, some not. He did not want to go through any of his crimes. Like, he was very eager to tell about the battles. And I also, wondered, why couldn't he say, yes, I was behind that very successful attack against the police station in Kabul, many from government forces killed. And then the two explanations to that, I'm not sure which is the right one, but one is that you never know who comes after, and they could be family members that would want to personally revenge on you if you say, you know, that is me. But then it's other saying, no, that would have been a big honor. And Taliban is a collective movement, so it's not seen as a good thing, because it's also usually never one person who heads an attack like that. But it's not a good thing to say, you know, that was my job. But it is a very collective movement, and unity is very important. And that is also what we see today, where, yes, there are definitely different views within the Taliban, but unity is more important. So he didn't want to talk about the crimes. So that is mainly, or the power games he didn't want to talk about. Because as the scholar I talked about, Abdul Sayyid, he had, you know, there's several books within the movement about the power games and so on. He didn't want to get into that. And of course, books in Pashto. And so the crimes.
Did you get a sense of him as someone who was rock solid in his conviction that what he was doing was right? Or did you ever see a flicker of, actually, you know, this doesn't sit so easily with my conscience? Because he obviously did a number of crimes that would make those of us of a more maybe blowing up hospitals is bad disposition think he's a bit of a monster.
Absolutely. Well, he is just defending his fatherland and the Taliban way of life. And he will think he has God on his side. He will not think, he will know he has God on his side. He's never, ever gone to secular school, or actually two first years he went to the Swedish Afghan Committee school. But after that, his all training is Quran. And he went far up. Most of the Taliban, they know the Quran and that's it. But he's done a lot of reading. Mostly it's like extreme Islamic reading that he's done. So most people probably think they're doing good. Like, he thinks he's doing good, that this is the way of life, and that we are being occupied by West, or first the Soviets and the West, and then Americans as such. Like, the West is usually, you know, he doesn't really differ between Norway or America, but it's like, we're all Americans for him. Yeah, so the question was whether he thinks his... What was the...
Well, it was just, did you ever get a sense from him of being troubled in any way by conscience?
No, I'm not conscious for the war. I think he's 100% happy for what he did during the war. And I also, there are videos online of him killing his own, because he was so mentally obviously sharp. That was, he was chosen at a very young age, killing defectors or traitors. So there are online some videos, I mean, you have to look well, where they take out the old guard of the Taliban who have become too soft, and Bashir is there and he's just shooting. There's a prayer and then he's shooting them in the head. Ooh. Whether he has a conscience about that, he didn't want to talk about that, because that's like, it was an order anyway. It's not his decision. He's ordered to do that and he's picked to do that. When it comes to the move forward, it was a bit interesting. So he doesn't let his daughter go to school. The sons, he teaches on the second floor, whereas the Quran school. actually the girls are also there, but none of them are allowed to go to school. He says about the boys, after they've done 12 years of the Quran, if they do want to become engineers or doctors or so on, they can. Of course, the girls cannot. And then came the ban on education while I was there, like that there was no education for any girls after 12 years, meaning, you know, what about, you know, there's got to be no more female doctors and so on. And then he said, being as extreme as he is, he said, oh, I don't support that. And I was like, how come? And he's like, I don't want my children to, I mean, my daughters wouldn't go, but if other parents want to let their girls go to school, let them go. So that was interesting for me to hear someone as extreme as him, even he is against the ban on education. So that is the main, probably where the Taliban movement is split into. And even he goes on the side of let them go to school and let just the parents decide and the families decide who's going to go.
Now, in counterpoint to Bashir, you have another character, Jamila. Can you tell me, did Jamila enter the picture? Were you always going to say, I want to find someone who's a human rights activist, who's a woman, who's progressive, as it were, though she is, you know, profoundly immersed in Islamic scholarship herself. I mean, did you sort of go, right, I've got Bashir in place, now I need to find the other side of the equation?
Well, it was actually the other way around. And the reason for that is just like, you know, Jamila just happened to arrive in Oslo because she was one of the evacuated women or activists. So the Taliban takeover was August 15th, 2021. She came to Oslo end of August. And, you know, different countries chose different activists. And I just heard her on a podcast like this, and she talked about her life, and she got all the way up to the government of Ashraf Ghani. She had left it a few years prior because of, you know, she didn't feel she could, or because of the rampant corruption, she didn't feel she could do it, you know.
That corruption, it's is one of the most extraordinary kind of close-up details of the book, that Karzai and Ghani's governments were, I mean, she was, what was it? She was in charge of the lists of compensation for those killed. Can you give us a flavour of that?
Yes, she was Minister of Martyrs and Disabled. And why martyrs and disabled, they put in the same group? Because it's mainly war victories. So it's like either you killed, you're a martyr, or you lose your leg and you're disabled. And she was a deputy minister. So this was part of the social minister's government. But this was her, you know, she was in charge of this. And then she gets there and she sees, you know, they're, at one occasion, there's a list with 70,000 names that are entering the war at the same date, and they die the next date. And there's, you know, everyone's getting their pensions, and all those pensions go into not one account, but, you know, a few accounts, and they go into the same pockets. And when she stops, you know, she's just like, okay, hold on. Let's just, you know, stop this for a while and investigate what's happening here. And it doesn't take long until, you know, she's getting phone calls from, you know, like, or actually meets in the corridor this man who's like, you dried up my well. And she's so tough. She just stays in it. And then there's bombs under her car and, you know, there's threats. They axe her desk to pieces. And then she also gets a phone call from the ARG, which is the presidential palace of Ashraf Ghani, where they just tell, you know, pay out. Because everyone, or not everyone, I'm not saying everyone's corrupt, but that is one of the, that is one also, when I said one major mistake, we didn't understand the Taliban. Another major mistake we did from the West, is we closed our eyes on corruption because we all had, you know, we had our projects. Let's say some of us, or some countries are doing hospitals, some are doing schools and whatever. If we told the public in our countries how bad the corruption was, the support for continuing would be less, you know. So it's like, it's also when she tries to change position of the people in her ministry just to find out, you know, where is the corruption, she gets this phone call again from the ARG saying, you know, put people back in their places. And he's like, if I can't even move and shake up my little ministry, like, how can I work? So she left, and so she had enemies, both, of course, the Taliban takeover, but she also had, you know, big enemies within the system. But Jamila, just, you know, quickly for the listeners to tell about her. She's a true revolutionary, growing up in a very conservative but very rich family. So not a Taliban family, but another family that, you know, girls are not going to school, boys are, you know, running it.
Is she growing up in Kabul?
She grew up in Kabul.
Yeah, I mean, there is a sense in the book, isn't there, that Kabul is one place and the rest of the country is a totally other. Is that a fair way of characterizing it?
Absolutely. I mean, there are intellectual elites everywhere. In the big cities, you find them also in, you know, Masjid-e Sharif or other big cities, even in the south, like, you know, Jalalabad or Kandahar. But of course, Herat, Kabul, Masjid-e Sharif is more open than the south. So the first page of the book, she's a baby and she's about to die in a very high fever, and it's polio. She survives the polio, but her leg doesn't grow. And that is what she tells me later. That's what saved me, because if I had had my two legs working, I would have been just like my sister, a commodity. And, you know, the price would be higher if these girls had never been seen, never been heard, nobody knew their names, heard their voices. So because she had that leg that didn't work, she could never get married. So there would be no bargain, you know, no price bargaining on her. And then she said, when she learned to walk on crutches, now I can walk. Let me walk to school with my brothers. And the father let her. And 1 year, another year, 1 year at the time, she all went all the way to university. And later with her, you know, this spirit of hers, when Taliban fell, when in 2001, because the education was in Pakistan, they had fled to Pakistan, into Peshawar, like many rich families did and others. And then she went back to Afghanistan, and her main thing in life is education and participation for all women, disabled, you know, rich and poor. So she's really broke out from her roots. And now she's actually in Canada.
And still campaigning and still working with her former colleagues in Afghan civil society?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, they're still working. And
with any great success? I mean, you describe these kind of slightly heartrending meetings in which they're always put in the room with the Taliban, and the Taliban make nice and then go home and do exactly what they want.
Yeah. Well, definitely. And the Taliban, they're so slick now. And I was really privileged to be able to document on that, because it's very seldom we hear from these meetings, to be able to report on the meeting with the interior minister, Sirajuddin Haqqani, who was also Bashir's closest, you know, superior and still is. And so the women in Jamila's organization and a few other women, there were five women in total, were able to meet him. And then two of them reported to me exactly what was said in that meeting and how he's like, oh, I didn't know that women were so, you know, that there were so knowledgeable and intelligent women in our countries. Of course, you will be part of the, you know, the conferences and the meetings. And it's also very like, even the travel ban that the Taliban introduced, that he was like, yeah, that's true. That's not really fair. And then it's interesting, like these Haqqani, Sirajuddin Haqqani, the interior minister, who was the main, how to say, the main bomb terrorist, almost, like he is the most...
Yeah, the Haqqani network's what everyone talks about, isn't it? Yeah.
The most lethal organization during the last 20 years. They have now become the most progressive within the Taliban when it comes to women participation. But even they... with the emir on top, who's against all of it, they can't do anything. So either he just sits and talks to, but why would he if he didn't mean it? It's this thing, why would he tell them? Like, they're no one to him. So it's like, I kind of actually feel that meaning, yes, he's saying more than he should, but that this is his opinions. And that also is proven in other circumstances where he, you know, he's been voting for more female participation.
Is your reading then, I mean, this is purely speculative, but that if there is this sort of ideological split in the Taliban and the emir is at the top, but you've got the most dangerous, powerful military network slightly against him, that could in some time depose the emir, or is the emir absolutely secure?
Yeah, I think he is absolutely secure because unity is more important in the Taliban than, I mean, no one is going to go to war over these women. They disagree on these issues, but honestly, for them, these issues are not so important. And the thing is with Emir that he's like almost chosen by God. No one can contradict the Emir when he's made the decision. To go into what happened before the ban on the schoolgirls is like was so interesting. I was there then, and we were going in the morning to, you know, the opening of all the schools. And then after midnight before came the decision that, you know, close down the schools. So in the book, I would say that's, you know, many readers think that's, you know, one of the heartbreaking parts of the book when one of the headmasters that I do follow, when they don't know this because they don't have internet to check that 8 o'clock in the morning, actually there's a school ban. So the school opened because the first shift starts at 7, like there are 3 shifts throughout the day to have room for all these children. So when she starts the school and they're so happily and finally after, you know, all these years you were back, and they get to into their classrooms, they start the first lesson, they get their books, their timetables, all of that. And then the headmaster gets a call. Send them home.
And they're scared, aren't they? I mean, even though they didn't know, there's this sense that, Christ, the Taliban turn up.
I think they're mainly just devastated. They're just devastated. And she's even like, is this a joke? Is this... And also the education minister wasn't aware of this. Like, he's planning everything, like, because the decision comes from the emir after midnight, the night before the schools are supposed to open. And what happens in that meeting in Kandahar, there's a 3 days meeting, but about different things. So there you have Haqqani, you have, you know, all different ministers. And what is happening is that everyone took for granted that, you know, now everyone can go to school, including the girls. So everyone has their, you know, all the ministers have their own things that are important for the mayor to do in their way. So they work on those issues because you can influence the emir until he's made the decision. But when he's made it, you can't go against it. So no one actually just fought for this. Like, they just took it for granted. Like, the Minister of Education also didn't bring his, you know, let me bring 12 religious scholars to tell why it's important for girls to go to school. Nobody did that. So when he just like listened to his people and was like, girls after puberty, no, why would they, you know, even be in the streets? That was done. That's not going to change.
And once he'd said it, it was a fatwa. And...
Yeah. So he, I think it's a bit like Putin, like, you know, he's never going to change. So you just have to wait for him to get away. And the same with Haibatullah Gonzala, like, he's not going to change. So it's like, you just have to wait for the next one.
And a third figure in your book, there originally wasn't going to be a third figure, was there? But tell us briefly about Ariana.
Yes, well, she is the one everything is about in a way that, you know, I thought I would do, you know, those two, Bashir, Jamila, more or less same age, but she's a bit younger, but they're fiercely fighting for their own.
Were they aware of each other, incidentally?
No. No, because it's different worlds, different spheres, absolutely.
Yeah.
And they both have the same surname that they invented, Al-Afghani. It's like Jamila the Afghan and Bashir the Afghan. And it's not very typical to put that name after.
So your title is actually
the
like the Smiths or the Joneses.
yes, absolutely. And then I met Ariana, who was then 20, who had studied law. She wanted to become a judge. And she was at the end of her first, you know, degree within the law studies. She had one semester left on that first degree when the Taliban came and the carpet was just, you know, drawn away under her feet. And she lost everything in terms of her future, because the only thing she wanted was to study. And we get to know her also like, as someone who loves America, and I think that's also important to put in the book because you have...
Justin Bieber and Stranger Things. It's kind of strange that she's got this cultural world which, you know, many listeners won't associate with, you know, life in Kabul for a young woman.
Yes, absolutely. And it's like she went to bowling, she went to cinema, she went to, of course, yes, she didn't have a boyfriend or anything, but that was almost like the only thing that differed her life from a Western life. She wasn't scared about the bombs. You know, it was, of course, she lives in a different surrounding, but she felt free. She had lots of girlfriends. They went to, you know, fast food stalls and walked around. And she was jogging around campus. She worked in a student radio from her salary. For her salary, she bought the latest Adidas tracksuit in order to jog around campus. It's just like that was how life was. And she didn't really relate to the Taliban. They were just some, because in Kabul, yes, there would be bombs. But apart from that, you didn't see them. They were somewhere in the mountains. And when they came, it was just something that, you know, really just didn't fit into her future life plan. And then she is the representative of those hundreds of thousands of girls her age who had freedom when the country was ruled after, you know, according to some liberal ideas. And then their parents let them. And then Taliban come. And what she says about her parents is that they were being Talibanized. So suddenly they're like, okay, we need to secure your future. We found you a husband. And she doesn't want to marry, and especially not a guy that the parents found. But it's like the end in the book is a bit open. It's like, I wanted her to be representative of several ones, like that. Is she getting into this forced marriage? Is she able to escape it? I leave that open. But of course, for most of these women, it's just, yeah. And it's not that all these guys are necessarily bad, but it's this thing that, you know, this was not what they wanted. And especially her being so ambitious and so, you know, top of the class always, very competitive. It was just like when I told you about readers telling me about Bashir, they are targeting the American tanks. The reader is with Bashir. I hope with Ariana that Ariana could be anyone's daughter, or it could be if you're a student, it's yourself, it's your grandchild, if you read it, like, because you can really relate, because her life and her ambitions in life are so much like any ambitious Western student. So I don't want people to be able to say, oh, but it's in their culture. How bad is it after all to get married away? It's like, no, but it could have been, it's you. It's really. So that is what you asked me in the beginning. What is the achievement of writing this as a novel, but based on facts and real people? Is like, a novel makes you enter into the mind of people. And it's, at least it's, I'm trying to make this as an inside account and not as, you know, what us telling about them. It's them, it's the Afghans telling about themselves and their lives.
Can I just ask you, just before I let you go, to pull focus a moment, to give me a sense of what your take on the question of the withdrawal was, because as you describe it, yeah, I mean, I think everybody has agreed that the way in which the Americans left, you know, was a disaster, and it left all sorts of people high and dry, and there were terrible reprisals. But were they wrong to leave in the first place? In the sense you describe this, you know, in extraordinary detail, the corruption and dysfunction of the Western installed and backed government. And you also describe a Taliban who are essentially, as long as the emir is alive, impossible to negotiate with, impossible to influence. I mean, is your sense we, one way or another, just have to throw up our hands and go, it's their problem, there's nothing we can do?
Well, I think it's not about the date when they left or what year, but it's what they or what we did those 20 years. I mean, maybe they should have left after 1 year. And it's also very tragic how we didn't catch Osama bin Laden, you know, within the first year, because the war on terror continued in Afghanistan in order to root out Al-Qaeda, even though Al-Qaeda had disappeared from Afghanistan. They disappeared over to Pakistan, so not far away, but that we merged the Taliban, which is the provincial, patriarchal, and, you know, terrible movement, but they're not a threat to the West. So we merged those two groups, still in the search of Osama bin Laden and the war on terror. And one of the reasons why the Taliban became so powerful was the war in itself, because that is a place where they could compete. Because, and also, this is an enemy that's not afraid of death, and it's you know, it's impossible, or it's very difficult to beat an enemy who's not afraid to die. So all the resources were put into the warfare. When you look at the numbers, the billions, the trillions that have been spent in Afghanistan, so much of it, it's the focus was the war. And then we closed our eyes to the corruption, to the fact that maybe the main commanders we cooperated with were the main narco barons in the country. We were so easy to fool because we had so many agendas at the same time. So had we left as military forces and more efficiently have taught the Afghan army, the government army, to defend themselves, like when the Americans left after 20 years, this was an army that couldn't fight without helicopters or planes from America. But there were no helicopters left functioning or planes functioning. So it was like everything, it was as if no one really planned for them to be independent. I mean, nobody sits with what would have happened if we'd left earlier. But big chunk of the Taliban, you know, they're interested in power. They're interested in, you know, being part of the ruling class of Afghanistan. But the only way to become part of the ruling class of Afghanistan, they had to gain all power. They had to go fighting. There were lots of Taliban who was like, okay, if I can keep my, you know, my farm, if I can keep my trade, whatever, I can live under the new, like Hamid Karzai, you know, live under the, who was the first Pashto president, live under them. But they weren't let to, because whoever had anything to do with the Taliban were arrested, off. It's a bit like the de-Baathification in Iraq. That's been, you know, one of the big mistakes, that none of the Ba'ath Party members could be part of the new elite. And then, you know, that they became the main core of the insurgents after a while, that, you know, made ISIS. So it's, I think that is what I would also say is one of the disappointing things now. Like, who is looking at the lessons learned in Afghanistan? We're now in the West in a new war with Russia. Like, you know, we're part of a big war between Ukraine and Russia. And how suddenly, like, Afghanistan is, you know, off the agenda, instead of like, is there anything from that part of the world where we fought for 20 years and invested so much, both in, you know, in armies and in dreams? Like, what did we learn from that? That's something that disappoints me.
Well, it's an inside start. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thank you.